So again, my name is Doran. I have been involved in some form of community organizing as a field for about 13 years now. 10 of those years have actually been at Isaiah. So I've had a long trajectory at Isaiah, and sometimes it's hard to separate my own development and growth as a Christian and a person and a public person from the growth and trajectory of Isaiah. Since there seems to be a spirit of confession in this, in this whole workshop, I just want to say that. What I want to do is just tell you a little bit about how I found myself on this path. A lot of what we do in our work and in all organizing, you know, there was something this morning where people were talking about moving out of the abstract. And I think actually Church of All Nations, and I just want to say just a second about Church of All Nations. Church of All Nations, I've been incredibly grateful for Church of All Nations' involvement in Isaiah, and for me personally, it's actually been an incredibly eye-opening, powerful. I'll just say that the influence is mutual. I'm Pastor Jin and John and Casey and Kendra. I mean, that's just the culture and way of doing church that happens at Church of All Nations has been just an inspiring, and I think we've actually drawn a lot on it. And so especially as we as an organization have struggled in the last 5 years, like all, frankly, Minnesota is struggling around the question of race. So I got involved in community. So I grew up in in southern Iowa. I grew up in a little town. I was rural. It's right on the border of Iowa and Missouri. And I grew up there during the 80s. And a lot of the landscape of my youth was the relentless crushing of our local economies. So when I was in second grade, all the dads went on strike at the Hormel plant. Most of them lost their jobs. People got laid off from John Deere. People's farms, smaller farms, were getting foreclosed on. Our downtown just was essentially abandoned. I mean, it was like there was just no business that could sustain itself in that economy. People moved. I mean, it was kind of like if people could, you know, everything, population shrank. And I was positioned in that in a much safer place than the people around me. Healthcare, both my parents were in healthcare, and so they didn't lose their jobs, and they weren't a part of what happened to families in those in the factories and on the farms. But I saw it happen, and my parents, for whatever reason, my dad grew up in western Minnesota in a little town called Slayton, and grew up there during pretty much the Depression. So he's a little older than my mom, and he has a kind of FDR Democratic from the old days, you know, like FDR sort of sense and Catholic sensibilities. So the sense of equality and fairness, and I learned when I became a Christian, I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute, but you know, this kind of term of stewardship, that we weren't stewarding people's lives. So my parents chose sides, and we chose a side in the strike. Like, we chose a side, and the side was with the workers. And that was a consistent value that I grew up with. But so even before I knew anything about politics or the economy or had any theories about any of those things, I knew that people I loved were getting hurt. And I knew that something was wrong when human lives were wasted or treated as if they had no value. And that's what happened to people in the now I know to call it the post-industrial globalization, of the Midwest, right? I mean, but that's, but the impact of it was people's livelihoods were taken from them and dignity. So that is, especially as I got older, I really, part of what I resonated with your testimony is it takes time to unearth, especially if you're white and you're middle class, it takes so much time to unearth this dis-ease, to know what it is, like to put words on it, to, and I myself, in a maybe a different way, but went through a process over time of being able to go, oh, that's my story. Like, that's where I come from. And that is one of the gifts of the culture of community organizing, because the belief there is that you can't act as a public witness until you know who you are. Like, you can't, you're not going to be political until you know what's at stake for you. And you shouldn't do it because of some abstract idea. You should do it because you know where you've been hurt, or you know who you love. That's a phrase recently. It's like, who do you love? And when we weave together the story for ourselves, where did I come from? What did my parents teach me? What did happen? What meaning did I make out of that? Did I know what was happening? What side did I choose? Why did I choose it? You know, what decisions have I made? Am I okay with that? I mean, like, those are, that process of unearthing is actually the path from the personal connecting to the political. Like, it's that work. And we don't do that work by ourselves. We don't do it in a vacuum, right? We don't do that work. It doesn't have, I mean, I'm not saying you don't do personal reflection, but we do that work because someone around us, or we put ourselves in a community where people ask us those questions. Why do you think? I mean, we could sit and spend the next hour having a conversation like, why voter restriction? Like, why do you care about that? I mean, you're a white, I bet you have an ID. Okay, like, right? So what is it? What is it, right? Like, what is it that's, what are you hungry for? What are you looking for? What is it that you care enough about that you're going to risk something? And this is this work of moving from the personal deeper and deeper into who I am and what my story is about begins to build, I mean, another way of thinking is it begins to build the resilience in us to risk with others for the sake of what our calling is. So I began that work, I would say. I actually, my reaction to growing up in Iowa was to get the hell out as fast as I possibly could. It was not, I'm gonna stay, I love my people. It was more, oh, this is a terrible place and I gotta get out of here, you know? So, I was good at school. I was middle class. I had privilege. So I was able to get out. Like, that's another reality. And part of getting out for me was going to university at the University of Chicago. And I went to school there. And I could tell you a long, long story. I mean, that's where I really became aware of race. I mean, I grew up in a 99.999% white place. But at the University of Chicago, like a lot of big universities, was a big, huge institution with the second largest private police force in the world on the south side of Chicago, not too far from Englewood, if people know that's very low income, considered dangerous black community in south side of Chicago. Anyway, I was racist, but I didn't really know about racism translated into being fear until I was at the University of Chicago, because they taught it I actually remember it vividly, but I didn't know until later, but it stuck in my mind that we had our O week and they were told us the boundaries that we could or shouldn't walk, and it was like, we can't help you if you pass 63rd Street. we can do nothing for you if you go across this park. I mean, it was like a, you must fear, you know. I mean, it, and so I had that experience, But I began, I mean, it was probably in college that it became more and more politicized. After school, I didn't know what I wanted to do, like a lot of post-college people. And I ended up doing a lot of theater, and then community-based theater. And then in that process, including, like, for example, we interviewed people who were political asylees in Chicago, and then worked with the Kovler Center for Human Rights and did a night of storytelling about, you know, like that kind of thing. And then I, in my neighborhood, one day was trying to figure out, like, I know I want to have a bigger impact and I don't know what it is and blah, blah, blah. And I was ranting probably about politics in this coffee shop in Logan Square. And a community organizer came up to me and he said, I'd really like to sit down with you and do a one-to-one. And I was like, dude, I have a boyfriend. I was just like, I have no idea what that is or why I would sit down with you, and it's creepy and weird. And he was like, no, I'm a community organizer. So I was like, what is that? Like, is it your job? You know, like someone pays you? But I did end up sitting down with him, and then I started, I don't know if it's like spirit, or I just started reading. I sat down with him, he introduced me to this thing, and then I started reading about it. And here's what I loved about it. The principle of it is, just like we just talked about story, that politics with a capital P is sick. That in order to actually save democracy, and I mean, this is, I'm telling you the narrative of community organizing, you know, in order to save democracy, the place that it starts is the everyday relationship between people on the ground, connecting their stories at kitchen tables, on street corners, in conversation. And when we collectively come together in simple ways, we can have an impact on the world around us. And that in and of itself is actually authentic politics. Politics, meaning electoral and parties and the powers and principalities, right, is something different than that. I meet you, we meet each other, we begin to identify what it is that we're struggling with. We can actually engage proactively with the world and change the things that matter to us. We can change things, and we can do the practice of politics, which is really co-creating our common lives together. And I liked it because it made sense to me, and because I felt like politics was a mess. I didn't think, you know, political parties were the answer. And I liked the way that it described relationships. It's not somebody doing something for somebody else. It's not someone who's really smart over here and then gives you a program. It's not a policy. It's not expertise or technocracy. It's we can actually do this together. Like this. So I drove myself into that work and became a community organizer in Chicago, working in neighborhood organizations on very localized neighborhood work. My first issue campaign was we got a patrol guard for a crosswalk in a neighborhood where the kindergartners had to cross the street to go, because, I mean, this is a sign of the larger problems. All the kindergarten was in a trailer, because there just wasn't enough room. But then the kindergartners had to cross the street by themselves, and they had no crosswalk or crossing guard for all these little five-year-olds. And the police were saying, we just don't have enough money. So we organized parents. The issue that they picked that issue, that was the thing that they mattered. We had a meeting with the police. We had a larger meeting with the police. And then eventually they said, yes, we'll put a crossing guard there. And there's something just about that is empowering for people who feel like in relationship to institutions they have no power. Do you see what I'm saying? Does this resonate? And are people, I just want to check in. Are you tracking with me? Okay. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, or I'm going to abstract for a minute. So this kind of work is actually a field in America. So it's a tradition. It's actually got, and it's not all community organizing or all movement building or all, I mean, there's actually like a countless ways that people have built social movements in America, I mean, since our inception. And so I don't want to universalize what I'm going to talk about, but there is a particular tradition that started actually really in the early 70s, somewhat in reaction to what some people felt like were the excesses of the sort of hyper left of the 60s, that built something called community-based organizing and then faith-based community organizing, which actually all shrunk itself down from larger, said that we have to do this kind of kitchen table politics and we have to build people's organizations that have enough power that they can work, get crossing guards and put up stop signs and get the trash cleaned up, right? Leverage city resources for their schools, and that the problem of poverty is not just that there needs to be a redistribution of wealth. The problem, or there needs to be another program, or there needs to be more services. The problem of poverty, wherever you see it, it's actually a sign of powerlessness. The problem is lack of power, not lack of programs or lack of charity. The problem is lack of power. Because when you see a powerful community, you see that their schools are shiny and clean, right? So it's like you sort of say, well, where is their power? Because it means people are engaged. It means there's accountability between institutions and communities. And where you see a lack of accountability between institutions and communities, that's when services get cut and actually we're not picking up your trash, even though we're supposed to be picking up everybody's trash, right? So this tradition of community organizing was about building people's organizations in places to build the resilience and power of communities to be able to impact their lives. So for those of you who have gotten a little bit involved, like in Gamaliel, it's just some of the, is this resonant? I mean, do you want to add anything, or are people to what I'm, the picture I'm creating of the tradition of community organizing? Or does anyone have any questions about that? with the faith piece of it,
yeah.
You'd like to look, yeah. So that's a great question, and I wanted to sort of establish the history of community organizing and then talk about where it intersects with faith, because there's places where it intersects and there's places where it does not. So faith-based community organizing actually started around the same time, and then in a spirit of confession, a lot of faith-based community organizing was really more about community organizing and not so much about faith-based community organizing. The reason they were organizing in churches is because churches were one of the last places in American society where people gather. They're anchor institutions in communities. It's a place where people are. It's an anchor institution. It has hope and potential for civic life. I would argue that the people who started faith-based community organizing, which I mean, you probably know all this history too, but it was really the mid to late 70s. And it was more grounded in a civic tradition than it was in a radical Christianity. So these faith-based community organizing tradition started to grew a lot during the 70s and 80s. And then these faith-based community organizations started springing up all over the country. And then there were four kind of major organizing networks. So they would say, we're a network and we do training and we help build these organizations across the country, that became kind of the vehicle through which a lot of this work happens. So Gamaliel Foundation is one of those national faith-based organizing networks. There's also the Industrial Areas Foundation, PICO, which is actually a huge presence in California. Yes, and we're a little more in a partnership with PICO now than we are with Gamaliel. So Isaiah comes from this part of the organizing family tree. So I hope I'm not boring you with that, but I feel like it's important to understand, like, this is this kind of very important but fairly invisible piece of American democratic tradition, which is this history of community-based organizing. It has a set of practices, it has methodologies, there's assumptions and worldviews, philosophy. It goes back, you know, it's a myth as much as it is a reality. You know, it's a real thing. And so then where I enter into this is I entered into faith-based community organizing 10 years ago because I went to Gamaliel National week-long training because I was in Chicago and somebody invited me to go and I was like, yay, I'll totally, you know. So I got to go to faith. It's a week of training. It's not a seminar. It's not like what anything you've probably ever experienced before. It's a very intensive unearthing of my story, engagement. There's actually a culture in this, they call it agitation, which basically means there are things that prevent you from taking that risk or being that leader. And so we're actually going to engage in a conversation about what's holding you back. So we can unpack that more in a minute. But so I went to this training, and for me, I did not grow up as a person of faith, and my parents left the Catholic Church, and I grew up in a very evangelical Pentecostal environment in southern Iowa. I did not have a good experience with that. I felt like, when he was describing this morning the hat and the snake skin and the tent meetings, I mean, I went to those things because, you know, I had friends who were into it, and I felt something there because you can't not feel it. I mean, it's not like God's not there. Like, God is totally there. But it was also, I was also like shocked and appalled, you know? I mean, it just was like, and the irrational logic that he was talking about of like, how does the logic, God loves you, but hates you, you know? Like, and hates lots of people. And I just couldn't. So my vision of Christian was that. So I went to the first day of his Gamaliel training, and I saw all these collars in the room and all these church people, and I about walked out. I was like, I thought this was organizer school. You know, I didn't know this was like faith people. I mean, but I stayed, and I had a lot of people who are more clear about their faith actually sometimes experience these trainings as not grounded in faith. I experienced it as faith galore. And I had a really profound faith experience that week. I hung out every night with this group of Lutheran pastors who argued about prayer. And they drank beer, which blew my mind. And I met this Catholic priest who was like totally priesty. I mean, he was like really a priest, and he dressed in black. You know what he was like? And he and I had this really profound experience that week. We really built a relationship, and he sat towards the end of the week. One of the most important moments for me is he sat me down and he just said, "Doran, there's one thing I want to say to you before, you know, you're not going to hell. It's not happening, and that's not who God is. God loves you." And I just had to hear that before I could open myself up to the possibility of God. And so it was like, it was such a gift. And sorry, that makes you cry. I've kept up a relationship with him for years because of that. And so it was a really, really amazing experience for me for faith. My deep hunger and desire for like transformative change in our world and for the radical possibility of faith being at the center of that. And so that is why I decided literally at like the day I was done with that week-long training, I am doing this. I don't know what it means. My husband came and picked me up, and I remember we were at this little diner, and I was like, I don't know what just happened to me. But I'm doing this, and I'm a different person, and you're going to have to deal with it. And like, this is what's happening. This is what I'm going. You know? So I ended up at Isaiah because it was the place where I could get a job. And we moved here in 2002, and so I've been at Isaiah for the last 10 years. Isaiah is out of this tradition of faith-based community organizing. We have between 90 and 100 member congregations, depending on the day or who decides they don't want to be part. You know, it's like there's always like a flux in and out. I would say that in the last 10 years, for those of you who are somewhat part of Isaiah or been in and out of Isaiah, it's actually been 10 years of incredible evolution. Actually starting from this tradition of faith-based community organizing, but actually moving away from it in lots of ways, or evolving pieces of it. And these are the places that it's evolved. Or let me say first like who we are, and then I'll say how it's evolved. Number one, Isaiah operates out of at the strategies and practices of community-based organizing, which believes that you have to, people have to unearth their story and their reality, work together, and overtly build power in order to impact for real the things around us. Power simply being the ability to act, and there's practice. Another way I put this sometimes is like people don't wake up in the morning and know how to do democracy. It's actually a set of public skills and practices for how to operate in the world. And so we do that together. There is a belief in this whole thing, and I was challenged this morning about from our speaker this morning. Is it Mark? Is that his name? Okay, got it. I think there's some similarities and differences, but we really believe that there's a transformative process of confronting the powers and principalities and unmasking their oppression and then saying it has to change. And that we can do that through democratic practice, mobilization, and social movement, you know? And so that's a huge part of what Isaiah does. And then we believe that we do that through intensive and transformative leadership development. So it's not about Doran being the director and going and doing that work. It's about hundreds and hundreds of regular people, right, who say, I'm hungry for this, or something's calling me in this direction, I don't know what it is, or, you know, that's what we instead of talking about volunteers, we talk about leaders for that reason, the Isaiah leaders. And we try to do this, I'd say thirdly, at greater and greater scales of impact. So rightly or wrongly, I got sick of doing stop sign campaigns. I feel like when there's mass incarceration going on, the biggest consolidation of wealth that's happened since the Gilded Age, millions of undocumented immigrants that don't have a path to citizenship, the destruction of the labor movement, a conservative ideology with whatever your politics might be, conservative or communitarian, which is fine, but like a kind of Christianized narrative of white supremacy. And I mean, it feels like stop signs don't address those things. So like, how do we take these principles and practices of community-based organizing, which is good, but has it really changed America? And the answer is no. So how do we have scale of impact? I think that's a question that I was wrestling with. So in the last 10 years in Isaiah, we actually, number one, said we don't just want to do organizing with churches. We want to be a faith-based organization in which people who enter the public arena, their identity in the public arena is that they are a person of faith, that they're a public witness. It's not civic. It's religious. And how does all of our work actually show up as prophetic witness and evangelization? And, you know, we can sometimes change things with small groups of people who are like deeply and profoundly and radically lifting out their faith, and that really what we're doing is unmasking powers and principalities and the dominant worldview, and our actions need to be about that. We do not do that perfectly by any stretch of the imagination, but that's the intent. I mean, that's what we're struggling to, how do you do that, you know? Secondly, I think we have, and I think this is, that was the core of some other changes. I mean, we still believe in building power, but we're also, and believe in building an organization that works on issues, but we also think that there's something that we need to spark here that's about movement, that isn't controlled by like a centralized plan. So how do you actually say, Church of All Nations, you're super awesome, and you have a vision, right? How does Isaiah become a vehicle for you to live out this vision without some centralized part of the organization like telling you what to do? It's sort of like, how do we do that? And still be effective, like still be accountable to effective impact, like real impact in the world. But that's a question. And then I'd say the third piece is race. Community organizing, as it developed in the 1970s, actually very officially said, we're not going to talk about race, and we're not going to talk about class, because they're divisive. And that's what broke apart the left movements in the 60s, was that they spent too much time talking about race and class, and then it all fragmented. And then you have, you know, the Weathermen on one end and the Black Panthers on the other end, and then Chicago happened, and there was the riots, and it was a mess. So we're not going to do that. We're going to be a non-ideological. We're not going to have a politics. We're just going to trust that if I get to know you, and even though you're Black and I'm white, somehow our self-interest, ahistoricism, will trump that, and we'll be able to work together without ever confronting our American history. That was the belief in the tradition. And we came to a certain point, I'll say I personally also came to a certain point, I just said, that's just not true. I mean, you can't even, the thing that's tearing us apart is that we're not talking about it. The thing that's tearing our movements, the reason we've let like a corporate conservative, as Jin Kim says, you know, Christian heretical agenda take over America has everything to do with the fact that we ceded a whole bunch of ground. It has everything to do with the fact that we haven't figured out how to do race. So Isaiah was a predominantly white organization. I think that the thing that's changed is we've struggled not necessarily to become a people of color organization. It's not like how do we put people of color on our board, but how do we actually have a multiracial consciousness, which is different than we're going to be diverse. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay, so we started that work and then said that has to go through everything. Like every issue we pick, we have to say, is it producing equitable outcomes? And how do we, you know, everything we do in the world, and then our internal leadership development and our training, and we have to change all of that in order to try to deal with this, like put race and class like back into the conversation and history back into the conversation. And again, it's very, very imperfect, but the organization has at least been it's been really working to go down that path. So the way Isaiah has changed from a lot of faith-based community organizing you might see in other places is it's much more faith-rooted, trying to actually awaken almost like an evangelized, like a radical faith. Two, we do race and talk about it and make people talk about it, have practices of talking about it, and we do explicit racial justice campaigns. Like the reason we're working on that is because this is about racial justice. And thirdly, we're trying to do more scaled up, movement oriented methodologies. So it's not just... Exactly. Can we build? So here being said, Can we build another great awakening that could confront mass incarceration in this country? Like, with as much evangelical fervor as has happened around pro-life or the right? Like, where people feel like, I, as a Christian, have to act on this because it's at the center of my radical identity as a person, you know? I mean, or, I don't know. You know, that's kind of the, maybe in 20 years we'll get there, I don't know. But that's the imagination that's been sparked. And some of that work, the way it's being manifest is actually through this campaign that we've launched called the Prophetic Voices Campaign, which is less about issues, and it's more about, can we actually link a loose network of congregations that can actually align around not just a common set of values, but a worldview and a vision very similar to what you've been talking about in the last 2 days about imperialism and empire and what it means to be a Christian in empire. And then whatever context people are in, so you can say certain things here that they can't say at Risen Savior in Burnsville, but wherever that line of the prophetic is, we're going to equip people to push there. It's sort of like, what's the next step? Because I don't believe that the answer is just to shrink down to a radical core. I'm trying to keep the big bucket, right, of the suburban white megachurch and Church of All Nations, like, living in the same, but finding a way that those things can link and connect and be networked and like and work and move in some common direction. We want to not abandon all those institutions, but figure out, can we align them in such a way that they show up in the public arena in more and more powerful ways? So that's very, 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 very challenging. But we're experimenting in a bunch of different ways about how do we do that. Okay. So that's a little bit of story about me and about Isaiah. So I guess what I'd like to do is just, number one, open it up for questions or reflections. Like, what resonated for you about this? Where do you feel totally perplexed? Like, I have no idea what she's talking about. You can totally say that. And we'll just have some conversation together.
Well, let me respond to that.
Yeah.
As I have experienced faith-based organizing, I found that what was critical to me was that I could sit down at least to a common table amongst those who say they have an understanding of faith. Versus community organizing in general.
Right.
And I've done both. Like, for instance, being part of a Hawthorne community organization, which is the community-based group, or down in Whittier, working with Whittier Lions, which is a community-based group. And when you go to those tables, you know, the language is all over the place. Are you talking property? Are you talking money? Are you talking...
Yeah.
Storefront when you're talking, yeah. But at least faith-based, it gave an arena or a table, I could say, where there's a spot where you could start, where you have some understanding. Look, we want to be about loving people.
Yeah.
And so that was extremely
important.
They're very important in the process. Through the years, I've learned that the significance of talking about race is there. It's got to be on the table. And further yet is not to necessarily just dwell on multicultural or multiracial.
Mm-hmm.
What you got to talk about is anti-racial.
Mm-hmm.
Question today is, are you an anti-racist? Okay, you know, for instance, how can Church of All Nations become an anti-racist church? Not just a multicultural.
Yeah.
But an anti-racist church. Because if that's not cleared off the table, or if that's not understood to be a commonality among us, relationship that is beyond beyond the racist issues. And in fact, I would further say, for you who are white, who are looking at doing community organizing, to you yourself, has grown to a level of understanding, where are you in your racism? Mm-hmm. You'll never be able to sit down with a community of color and say, I understand. You'll never be able to, because your frame is referred to as a white racial frame.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're going to lose something. Well, hey, got news for you. You're going to gain something.
Too, absolutely.
Called other relationships. Profound relationships. Yeah.
Right. No, I think that's really helpful. So what do people think about, we kind of tipped on this, and it just might be a good place to dive in. The essence, no matter how you name it, and even though I've described some changes that we've undergone, is that faith and politics go together. And that churches have a role, congregations and faith communities themselves have a role to play, not just individuals going off and doing things, but the institution, like the church, has a role to play in the public arena, confronting the powers and principalities for not symbolic protest, but outcomes that change people's lives. You see what I'm saying? You see the difference between the two? I'm all for a protest, but I think what's more important is, did something change? Did more jobs go to people of color in Minnesota? And were the people that are in positions of power, did they change their policies and practices to make that happen? Do you understand what I'm saying here? This is different than. Yeah. What are people's reaction to that vision?
I really like your speaking now. Just how you see Isaiah evolving, because I always, from what I understood, political organizing, logical,
right. Right.
In that your faith doesn't influence politics. So you have Christian conservatives saying, vote for this guy because he's, God. And through the studies, through my studies in Mennonite education studies, Goshen College, looking
Yeah.
Ways of looking. And so.
So, let me put a counter picture out there. Well, I don't know if it's counter, but let me put a picture about what I mean about faith in politics. So, people of faith you're awakened by your faith, and it's actually if your faith is authentically awakened, it becomes connected to your politics and your story. I also believe your story is when you unearth it, it actually tells you a lot. It's sort of like everything you need to know is already in you. If you just map it, like know it. Okay, so then let's say we say, because of my experience and my stories and my faith, want to like lift up the dignity of other human beings. And I look around me and I see racial inequity everywhere. And I look at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. People aren't getting jobs. Why aren't people getting good jobs? So this is like an actual process that what happened in Isaiah. Set of congregations, people from those congregations themselves were contractors or had gone through apprenticeship and training programs and still couldn't get a job on a construction site. They went through a set of trainings like, okay, well, you can sit around and complain about that. You can pray about it. You can be angry about it. You could even yell at someone about that. Or we could get organized and we could go, number one, figure out what the problem is, and number two, try to make it somebody's responsible. It's not the weather. It's a set of decisions that are being made by people who have power. We're going to go find them. So that means the people, and this is what I mean by you actually get trained in practices. There are practices for doing this, meaning I'm going to actually go meet, I'm actually as a person going to have enough, and the organizing transformative process is, are you brave enough to go sit down and talk to your city council person? You have every right to go talk to him. You have every right to talk to him about the things that matter to you and not to him, right? So you go do that. Then we figure out after all these people get engaged of actually figuring this out, then they go and say, the problem is we can't get a deal between the contractors and the trades and the apprenticeship and training programs and MnDOT, the regulatory agency that could be saying we're going to set a goal and we're going to make sure because we have the purse strings about who gets the contracting dollars. We could say, no, we're going to put these policies and practices in place, and unless you hit X goal, you're not going to get our contract next time. But they're refusing to exercise their authority because they're really in bed with the contractors.
That is, in a sense, institutionalization.
Yes.
And so the denominations must talk about anti-racism because they're institutions, or any institution, because there's institutionalized racism. But what about right now, the individual people organizing? What we're saying is that institutions exist. However, we believe that there's an empire and ultimately we can be better together.
Yes.
Continue to do work at the legislative if people see that, but also continue to say there's a much more radicalization as people of faith to co-op community organizing of the faith-based mixture, interfaith. And I think people are still at a place.
The church is already divided. Actually, what happens is sometimes when you open up, you create the tension, you just expose the divisions that already exist, okay? It's like letter from a Birmingham jail, okay? So what are some other people's... So this is... I'm telling you this story about the Department of Transit because it's a true story. Like, this was a campaign that got run through Isaiah that used multiple strategies that was ultimately aimed at making the Minnesota Department of Transportation use their power to actually meet their goals for the hiring of people of color on construction projects. And it came out of a set of three African-American congregations that said, this is the thing we want to do. Now, what do you think happened? Do you think that the commissioner of the department, the commissioner of transportation, was happy to see us? When there was a set of meetings, what did Ghani say? That first they said, we're trying really hard. And a lot of people go away after that. Yeah, we're the experts, right? We're the authority. We're taking care of it. Or then trust us. Yeah, and I have the same values as you. There's a set of things that people in power say, and it's not because they're bad people. They actually kind of believe it. Does this make sense? I have a whole binder filled with women. Right, exactly. I laughed when that happened because actually in the Civil Rights Department, the Department of Transportation, they actually said things like that. Or even worse, we can't find any qualified people. We want to hire, but no one's qualified. I have a list, right? So then what happens to people who have never experienced power... Right. This is why it's so important to know my story and where I'm situated and race, and because they also tried to divide the group around race, because white middle class people in that meeting actually ally with other white middle class people, and they have more alliances with institutions. Okay, you actually are more sympathetic. Unconsciously, you believe the bureaucrat, just like you believe the police are on your side. Like. So if you're in a room and there's African American people and there's white people, there was a lot of conversation that had to happen before those meetings where we created an honest space where the African American leaders could say to the white leaders, if you cut the rug out from underneath us in that meeting, we will never walk. We will never take another risk with you. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, we will never take another. We're taking a risk with you right now. We're risking more than you. Right? If you imagine, do you think that was kind of transformative for the white middle class people? Yeah. It's like, okay, but then when you go into the meeting and you watch this happen and then to debrief it afterwards and say, how did they try to divide us? Like, where did race enter into the conversation? How did power operate? Like, where were you positioned in that power? Like, who had privilege? Or even training white people, you can know your privilege, you can try to get rid of it. Part of getting rid of it, though, sometimes can be using it. Yeah. So, like, in St. Paul, on some of these minority contracting issues, the Black Ministerial Alliance said, we've been trying to get a meeting with the mayor for 3 years. All of a sudden, when Isaiah joined up with them and there was a bunch of white pastors, they got a meeting and the meeting happened. But then to train the white pastors not to, again, like, not to ally with the mayor... Now I'll have to tell you, the mayor hates Isaiah. Don't ever talk to Mayor Coleman about Isaiah. He hates it. And then his staff started calling all the clergy using race as a divide. One-on-one. Yes. I mean, it was like, these are... So once you get out of the bubble of our being... Because we're all addicted to our innocence, okay? And you start entering into the realm of powers and principalities, you see how it operates. And the act of bringing our faith into politics is less about, like, how we vote. It's about how we actually do this work of transforming power around us. Do you see what I mean? Because I think people are so confused about politics. They think politics are voting. Or am I for Barack Obama? No, politics is this radical act of saying we are going to shift the nature of how power works. Do you see what I'm saying? Is that what you're getting at? Okay. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And so what I'm saying is, like, for example, how
Yes. So part of, oh, no, go ahead. You go ahead.
I've been through ethics, and it sounds like there's a lot of elements in common in this deconstructing.
You mean race?
Yeah.
Like, or privilege?
Anti-racism. Because ethics is a really good job of saying, what's your story? Because you have a racial story, even if you're white, especially if you're white. You've been, so they start with socialization. What is socialization? What have you been socialized to believe?
Right.
So is that a part of
your
training?
I haven't used this particular term. I would like to learn more about it.
Because
we should definitely talk. We've done some training with Professor John Powell from the Kirwan Institute, Applied Research Center, Terry Kelleher, and who's done some of the white privilege training. And we've done some I was actually saying to them this at lunch. We actually spent, I don't even know if CAN was a part of Isaiah back then. We did these, we put the 100 core leaders in a room and made them stay in a room all day and talk about race and tell their race story. And, you know, we've done a lot of that stuff and done a lot of work with white people. It's so awkward. and then tried to incorporate a practice of calling it out, you know, so everyone's really uncomfortable, but you were just being condescending and patronizing, or like when you say this, it's really your privilege, or, you know,
correct.
In real time. Yes.
That is the real.
Yeah.
You know, talking about this. Dr. Charles, I think, really described the process of truth and telling.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
everyone
has a story.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Even as Dr. Charles looked at last night, even when you go back to our history, our founding history, there's a story.
Right.
So you've got to look at the truth in telling that story. Because the story has been told to us that even though they're coming from religious experiences, okay, as they pull whatever they want to call us together, the story they told us was keep church over here. Mm-hmm. Keep politics over here.
Right.
Even though they came from this church setting. So as we learn the story, that's what we learn. Politics here, church there. You know.
That's part of the imperial story.
Yeah.
So part of our experience now needs to be unlearning the story. Truth telling about the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in doing that, then we're able to, I think, accept the realities of, okay, you know, all these structures that have been, you know, implanted, talk about institution and have us convinced that there is this invisible thing called institution.
Right, you know, exactly.
But the reality is that we're the institution.
We, it's us, yeah.
We're
exactly.
Church.
What are we going to do?
So as Isaiah presents to us an avenue, a way that we can come together, and we can say, no, we don't want this anymore.
Yeah.
We can compile our voices. We do that critical mass, which is very important.
It really is. It's sometimes hard, but it is important to build mass.
Right. And as a person of color coming with, when you're dealing with a community of color.
Yeah.
We need allies. We need white allies.
Right.
And in my having a white ally, I need to trust you.
Right.
To go to that table of whites.
Right.
And say, hey, this is not right.
Right.
Okay.
and not get split off, which is what happened. Yeah.
Because without our relationship, without us developing
trust.
Trust among ourselves, then we will, as they want us to be, remain divided.
Right. Exactly. Do you have another question? Or
yeah. I'm wondering, I know you have community-based organizing, really, or faith-based community organizing really was rather civic in
yes.
the beginning. I'm wondering what theological work is being done, and has been done. I hear elements of, you know, where a liberation theology would be very powerful, considering that it comes from the people. People have agency to liberate themselves,
right?
Which is really important. That it's not, you know, top down. You know, we're gonna do what we see fit for you people.
You people, right?
Say how it is. And I just think about, you know, your question about faith in politics. Politics is from our faith as Christians from the beginning. I mean, even, you know, the Israelite people, it's all, the Bible is a political book. The cross is a political symbol. So if we can, I just wonder about the teaching that's being done in our churches, the theological teaching, that would lend more to being able to organize.
I think it's a huge missing piece. So part of our investment in prophetic voices was really about calling a set of clergy forward to do some of this work. Actually, the piece that John has in your folder, the piece that he wrote, the sociopolitical lens, he wrote that as a part of a process, which I found one of the most helpful documents I ever read. I think churches are just, they're just, it's like the institution, they're not teaching this radical teaching or forming. Spiritual formation in most churches is a privatized, my relationship with Jesus, am I saved thing, and a kind of, Jesus is my boyfriend, and... or an anemic... boring. I mean, the other experience, besides being shocked and appalled, my other experience of church, it was just boring. I mean, it's just like, what? I mean, what does this have to do with anything? So I think part of what we're struggling with is how do you take churches that are more like the mainline and give clergy and ministry staff the tools to begin having other kinds of more formation, of spiritual formation and Christian formation. And I don't know how to do that. I also would just say seminaries are not equipping clergy to be this kind of religious leader.
It's like your framework when you come to the table at seminary and what you're receiving. Because, you know, I feel like I've come to seminary now, I'm at seminary now, with a certain framework that I didn't have before.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in theology, I have a critique of the way we teach theology. You know, we have one week of contextual theology, the 1 week of liberation, feminist, you know, the rest is all patristic. But I can listen to this, I can learn this theology that we're all steeped in very deeply and understand where the church has come from.
Yeah.
And where we could enter in a different way.
In a different way.
But on the whole, seminaries are not preparing pastors because we're out of touch with what's on the ground, the communities just right around us.
It's both preparing, not preparing pastors theologically, but there's also like a pragmatic side of it. It's like, so let's say you have all the, that's what it is.
It's not, someone was talking about.
How would you lead, you know, like.
Practice reflection.
Yes. In seminaries. I've experienced a lot of clergy. We do a lot of work with clergy, and actually in the last couple of years we've been doing more and more work with just clergy. And John referenced it. I mean, clergy are isolated in institutions. They don't know how to move. They don't know how to galvanize, awaken their people. They feel beleaguered. They're stuck. They don't remember. They're drained and burned out. And their initial reason or call into the work has, this is for a lot of clergy, it's true. Like, it's just not alive. So being able to, like, nourish, invest, agitate, and challenge as well clergy to be prophetic religious leaders, both with their following and in the world. Because, I mean, that's what we need from them, you know? And, I mean, that's a very challenging task, but I think a critical piece of it is, I mean, when we had the clergy at the preaching workshop that John helped lead, and he read this piece, you know, everyone read that. There was about 80 clergy there. You could have lit a match and the room would have exploded. I mean, it was just, they were so energized. Like, this is, like, I've kind of known this before. I vaguely remember it from seminary back in 1968, but, like, I haven't been in a room where I could talk about it for 30 years, and I need help. I want to talk about this stuff. How do I talk to my, you know? So I don't know how to build the infrastructure for more of that to happen, but it feels like our work building movement out of congregations is actually never going to, like, take off until the fertile soil is created.
I feel hopeful and pessimistic in the same.
At the same, yeah.
We're the
I know.
And our back.
What happened? There's a Reformation. It was like nailing the theses to the wall. That's part of it.
I wonder how much of the challenge is in churches, unlearning the language of survival. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems that the church is saying, as long as I can have my doors open and, you know, have a place for my members to be.
Pay our mortgage and, yeah.
No, have their funerals.
Oh.
Having a place. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, on Saturday. Seems to me that's the challenge.
Sure, and it's not making sure that you have a place for a funeral is a good thing. It's just how you do that within the context of going about doing that, relying on bank industry to support you for your funeral, or rely on, you know, how about we set up a program where there's zero funding, and everyone pitches in what they want for the funeral, and by, you know, by trade and by organizing across race and class lines, the pot becomes bigger. I mean,
the Presbyterian.
The challenge becomes if from the pulpit I speak truth, am I going to have my members sitting on Sunday morning?
I think the key to that is, I think
there's some other place to hear comforting words.
I think the key to that is, though, that I think pastors often imagine that the place that they display their leadership is from the pulpit. There's all kinds of other work that needs to happen of actually equipping and preparing people to even hear what you're saying in the pulpit. So, I mean, part of what's interesting about Church of All Nations is there's clearly like a formation that's happening with people, like not just on Sundays. I mean, it's personal work. It's one-on-one. It's relational. It's leadership development. It's so that you're not just excoriating your parish from the pulpit and then running back to your office and locking the door, you know? Which a lot of clergy, when they get agitated about, like, oh, I need to be more prophetic, what goes on in their mind is they think I need to, like, give an anti-war sermon or something.
Drop a bomb and run away.
Yeah, drop a bomb and run away. Exactly. As opposed to, no, it's a lot harder work than that. It actually, the work is picking 20, 25 people in your congregation. You're going to go meet with them. You're going to actually say, wow, you're saying something about voter restriction. I want to know more about that. Like, I'm going to train you. I'm going to pull you in. You're going to be my base in the congregation for advancing the transformation of this church. The problem is most people think their mission as a clergy person is to preside over the death of the church. Manage its hospice care. I'm not in charge of changing it. I'm not really responsible for whether it lives or died. Yeah, but it's also like, it's not even that. It's like I'm sort of presiding over its death. Hospice care. I'm going to be a pastoral. That's the vision. So if that's the vision, then like nothing will change. But if the vision is, no, my role is to awaken 20, 25 people strategically, and then we're going to advance X, Y, and Z, and we know exactly who's going to be against us, you know? And we're going to create a situation in which we can actually move mission, as opposed to, but it's an organizing project, not a speech-making project.
It's something where I know that, but first and foremost, I have never felt like I was being recruited for a project, because that was, I mean, that's been one of the things I really appreciated being here so far in this hearing your history about Isaiah and come where it comes from, because I have struggled quite a lot with the fact that Isaiah often still uses vocabulary and
yeah.
Rather than about, I mean, I think one of the things is that it's true, like this critique of clergy as being like Washington, you know, being the one singing the dirge as everyone, you know, like that's what the call is. But really, there is a call, and it's not, but I don't believe that it is a call to have conversations, you know, to strategically move people. But because what I've experienced has been life transforming. My personal transformation and growth, and recognizing that, like, I, you know, being equipped to speak and understand, like, what does it mean for me to be a white girl who moved from Canada to Minnesota? Like, what does it mean for me to be an immigrant? What does it mean for me to, like, what does that mean for me to be in this country that basically says, like, here's the criteria of what it looks like to be successful, and I am, you know, and I fit in, and people don't question whether or not I belong, but at the same time, I always know that there's somebody there who's telling me that I don't belong, because I have to go, I still have to get up in the morning and stand in the line, and I still, you know, and my dad still gets treated in a certain way that by his employers, and these are things where, like, I think that being in a congregation, being in this congregation, has been transforming and empowering and helping me understand and be able to have that open conversation about race and what does it mean for me to be a beneficiary of privilege, but then to be in a congregation where really, like, we are part of a family, mm-hmm. and then just learning to expand that family in a lot of ways and recognizing that I don't have to be ashamed of the fact that I'm a white immigrant, but that I can
also recognize that this is a part of who I am and part of like what it means to me to interact with others. And when I hearing about like what Isaiah is doing or in voter ID, like I'm excited because I can actually vote for the first time this year. And so when I'm, you know, like this is something that I do care about and that I want these are people, like I am in relationships with people that have been passed. Yesterday I went to get my passport, apply for my U.S. passport for the first time, and I went to one place, but then they're like, we're not accepting passport applications, so I had to go to a different place. And I was like, are they trying to tell us that there's not barriers to getting an ID? but just, I think that in, like, it's interesting to hear and like, think about like what it means to be part of a community and to be active and to be involved in the civic engagement. And it's refreshing to hear the confessions that community organizing when thrown with face and sticker on it was really not actually about faith and development, and I think that for me, I'm still in this process, and I'm excited to be in it, of understanding what it means for me and my faith, and what it means for me to be engaged and interacting with the youth that are in our church, and with the other members in our church, to be building relationships, because that's where change really happens. I mean, when we look at like what Dr. Charles was talking about last night, like, look at Jesus, he wasn't particularly successful in the end, in his movement. In the end, he died alone, pretty much. And even, like, the 12 people that he had with him, like, were all scattered. There's a couple of ladies who couldn't do anything. And, like, and so then it's also very scary for me, because I feel like, in my own experience, like, you're taught to, like, go for as much education and as much...
Mm.
Power that you can accumulate, and then you can use that to like be as generous as possible and recognizing you can inconvenience yourself, but at the end you still have to not take too many risks. I think it's very interesting.
So I really appreciate that. There's a lot in what you said. I want to go back to one thing. Do you think that transformation or community building is mutually exclusive from strategy? Having a strategy.
Not necessarily, but there are.
About strategy?
So here's an example. Rosa Parks was specifically chosen. And there was someone else who was specifically told they should not play that role because they were pregnant. And Rosa Parks, at the committee, was chosen to be strategically placed on the bus because she was the right political person for the story to advance, and that she would be the one that would be able to galvanize the people to actually launch the strike. And there was months and months of strategizing amongst the church leader, a small group of church leaders and women a set of women who were the real organizers, to actually set the stage so that there could be a political confrontation. And it was a set of strategic decisions. Does that mean that somehow it was false? Or wasn't transformative or manipulative for that to happen in order to actually stage the confrontation that would unmask what was happening?
I don't think that there are things that are mutually exclusive. I do think that...
And I'm not saying it's not a dangerous business.
Right, yeah. Right. And that's what I'm saying. And productivity.
Yes.
It's very challenging for me, having like within our church been challenged on that, and being like saying, we're glad to have you no matter understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who you are. So then it is a challenge to figure out what it means to enter in a community and where strategy is valuable in order to have to make it a challenge. And then it does like transform individuals. And I have, even in Isaiah, I have appreciated that, but then there are also times where.
It's like, am I being placed someplace? Right.
Yeah.
Oh, see, that's terrible. That shouldn't have happened.
Oh, okay, yeah, no. And
yeah.
That was not.
No, that's terrible. Yeah. No, I'm sorry that that should not have happened. And that's if it's. I'm glad it wasn't a staff member. Okay, because have a heart attack. Like, that's an ill-equipped leader,
right.
Who's okay. What I also want to say though is And I struggle with how to talk about this, but like when you're trying, like even in a church, like Church of All Nations actually attracts people to it because of who it is. But let's say a church has 9,000 people who are coming to it because it's a civic, cultural, traditional experience, not a radical faith. And you have a pastor and a set of people in that church who want to advance or change that place. They need a strategy, right? You can't change it without a strategy. You can't. And part of that strategy actually includes, just like Jesus did, picking the 12.
I think.
Like Jesus picked the 12.
Yeah. There, I think what I hear and what Kendra's saying is that, and maybe it's in the language, is that you're going to these people with a mindset of who here. You know,
oh, can give me what I want.
Community organized, like a part
yeah.
of it. Rather than, because, you know, in the with the passage that we were talking about, her dying or her death or whatever, if I'm called to a church like that, I hope that I will love them to death.
Sure.
You know? Like, I will, you know, that's my agenda first, because I think that's always should be the agenda first. And I think at Church of All Nations, because we have more than just being, you know, multicultural, putting flags up on the wall, that we have a diverse community that's intimate with each other,
mm-hmm.
that we understand ourselves as intimately connected because of we have meals together, because we know each other, we're in each other's homes, we're family. It's out of that. I mean, I can speak of experience after experience after experience of experiences I would not have had if I was not in deep community with people who were having experiences different from me
right.
at the hands of political forces, you know. And so I think that, you know, coming with an agenda of maybe it becomes one more liberal agenda. Rather than a real community of faith working with and for each other together. I don't know if that's
yeah. And I
think yeah, that's of, helpful. Yeah. Oh, is it time?
There's a break coming up.
And okay.
So we're going to be back in here soon. So
okay. And when is it? I think we're actually past
break,
it.
So
oh, I should break. Okay, I'm really sorry. Sorry, I lost track of time. All right. We'll end it. Okay. So I just wanted to, I feel like we opened up something really important here, and I really want to thank you for doing that. So,
Casey, what about the chair?
Yeah, should we move them back?
Yes, chapel. Yeah. Well, we definitely need four here.